Hello and welcome to the program, UFO Warning. In this episode, we're looking at five famous Ohio UFO cases. That's correct, five famous Ohio UFO cases. Now, the article comes to us from MiamiCounty.com, written by Matt Bayman. I found the article to be done really well, excellently written. Now, before I get into the article, I just want to point out that I appreciate the support that I've gotten on Buy Me a Coffee. Been doing a little bit of collecting there, and also the support that I've gotten on the Spotify monthly donations count. Now, it's not a huge amount of money, but it's starting to add up a little bit, and I really appreciate it because I've been looking around for a different mic to use for the podcast, and hopefully we can get that together sometime during this month, and hopefully listeners will appreciate that. You can let me know. I'll let you know when to get it hooked up. Also, I've been working on refiring up the website. It won't be anything too special, but it'll be a place where we can keep links to the stuff that we cover on the website, and some people say that's easier for them, so if I get it, hopefully people will use it, and that'll just be another resource that we have. Now, this article begins by saying, according to research conducted by Alphoria, and based on reports filed with the National UFO Reporting Center, Ohio ranks 8th overall in the United States for the most UFO sightings. Since the 1950s, there have been more than 4,100 reports filed in the Buckeye State, including many in western Ohio. A majority of the sightings turned out to have simple explanations, such as being weather balloons, military aircraft, or some kind of weather or astronomical phenomenon. However, quite a few remain unexplained. With this in mind, here are five of Ohio's most tantalizing and notorious unsolved UFO cases, including some that occurred in our own backyard and several of which involved Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and its famous UFO investigative unit, Project Blue Book. Imagine that. He begins by saying, 1932, St. Paris, one of the earliest photographs of a UFO ever taken. The photograph below was taken in St. Paris, Champaign County in 1932. It is considered one of the earliest possible photographs of a UFO ever recorded. Only two earlier ones are known to exist. It shows George Sutton, a local resident, and what appears to be a classic UFO-shaped object over his left shoulder. Now, I'll post a link on the Buy Me a Coffee site, and when I get the website up and running, I'll have a link there. But this picture is awesome. 1932, you know, I can imagine probably like a little brownie camera or something, if they even existed then. They're pulled over to the shoulder of the road. You can see the car behind him and the license plate. The guy's standing there looking into the camera, and they snap a photo. Now, the picture's not centered exactly right if you're just taking a picture of the guy. The guy's kind of on the left of the picture, and then to his right is the highway. And his left shoulder, to the right of the picture, at the very top, you see a UFO. Now, some people said, oh, that's a street light. Well, that's just insanity. That street light would have to be about, 800 foot tall. I mean, clearly this is a UFO, and it's photobombed, this picture, in 1932. I find it hilarious in a way. It says, the photo is also intriguing. It says, it shows George Sutton, a local resident, and what appears to be a classic UFO-shaped object over his left shoulder. Skeptics say the object is simply a street lamp. No way. But according to the folklore that surrounds this image, there were no electric street lights along this road in 1932, nor any wires or poles visible in the image. The photo is also intriguing because it predates the flying saucer craze of the 1940s and 50s. It was taken before the alleged Roswell UFO crash in 1947. And 6 years prior to the broadcast of the War of Worlds in 1938, when some people believed aliens were attacking Earth. In other words, the person who took this photograph either captured a street lamp, a real UFO, or was way ahead of the curve in terms of pulling a good hoax. So 1932, like they said, before Roswell, before World War II, I mean, this is clear back there. After Roswell, a string of photographs that look very similar to the St. Paris image began to appear in newspaper tabloids across the United States. Most of them turned out to be hoaxes that involved common household items such as a lamp and hubcaps being thrown through the air and photographed. From a skeptical point of view, the owner of the St. Paris photograph didn't make it known until after the saucer craze began. Had they just noticed the object in the picture before, or did they see a chance to pull a good hoax? Also, you have to wonder why the photographer focused their camera on the middle of the picture on the middle of the road, not on Sutton and his car? I don't know. I mean, I look at the pictures the people I know that have taken. Most of them aren't centered. Most of them are just kind of thrown up there. There's another article on this from, it says, ufology.patrickgross.org, classic photograph cases. And it has a picture here. It says, this picture taken by George Sutton of St. Paris, Ohio, was taken near midday on a summer noon in May 1932. We can see that it was 1932 from the license plate on the automobile and the photo that accompanied the shot. The unidentified flying object in this picture could not have been a street lamp, because simply because there were no street lamps at the time. I mean, think about it. This is a Great Depression, okay? I'm not sure that out here in the middle of nowhere, Ohio, they were going to bother to have street lamps turned on, honestly. There are no power poles or power lines visible in this picture. Now, I think I do see a telephone pole back here in this picture. But man, you look at the telephone pole, and so, you know, what is it going to be, like 30 foot tall or something? And then you look at where the UFO's at, it's like 10 times, you know, as far as the distance of the pole. So if we just use the trees in the foreground here and the telephone, what looks like a telephone pole, I'm not sure, in the front, that alone shows us that this UFO is not a street lamp. This would have to be the biggest street lamp known to man. Anyway, it would have to be suspended about 500 foot up in the air. And they have a close-up shot of this UFO here where it's been blown up a little bit. And it's almost like one of these bell-shaped things. I mean, it has a saucer shape on the bottom, but then it's got this kind of bell structure on top of it. Pretty good detail for 1932. It says there are no power poles or power lines visible anywhere in this picture. This picture of George Sutton of St. Paris, Ohio, taken near midday, shows a vintage automobile with a 1932 license plate on the front bumper. The owner of the photo album says there were no electric street lights along this road. So that's not folklore. That's a person that took the picture. In those days, nobody has been able to account for the dark object seen over Sutton's left shoulder in this photograph. Yeah, it's a fantastic picture. Like I said, you can link to it. I'll put the links up at Buy Me a Coffee. Now, it goes on here for the next one. This is one I found really interesting, too. 1949, Norwood, Ohio, the Searchlight UFO incident. Basically, what happened here, they did a big fundraising thing for a local, I think it was a Catholic church, and they brought in a searchlight, 1949, just after World War II. That would have been a big deal. And while they're operating the searchlight, they see a UFO, and not just any UFO. A UFO that's like 2 miles long. And the thing was, they didn't just see it one time. They saw it multiple times for multiple days after that. So here, let's get into it. As a way to raise money for a new church parish in Norwood, Ohio, a suburb of Cincinnati, Father Gregory Miller decided to host a carnival in August of 1949. Of course, back then, carnivals would have been big deals. The carnival would include a trapeze act, so it was decided that the church would use a searchlight to not only showcase a trapeze artist, but to attract visitors from far and wide. The searchlight was capable of shining a beam of light 6 miles into the sky. The church sought help from Sergeant Donald R. Berger of the University of Cincinnati's Reserve Officers Training Corps. He was a qualified searchlight operator who kept meticulous logs while on duty, including during the carnival. According to his accounts, on the first night of the carnival, sometime after 8 p.m., he was operating the searchlight when it came upon a massive object in the sky. His log states, quote, "The object was stationary, appearing as a glowing disk. When I moved the searchlight away, the disk continued to glow. He estimated the object to be 4 or 5 miles in the air, around 25,000 feet, and reported that the sky was clear with a thin haze of at altitude. More than 100 people saw the object that night, including Father Miller. Maybe nothing more would have come from this incident, but the next day, local newspapers carried stories about strange lights reported all over Cincinnati, not just at the carnival. At least three major newspapers in the area ran stories about the sightings. So what we had was a mass UFO sighting. And it's got a picture here of this searchlight shining up into the sky. Okay, this what they said was actually a photocopy of the picture. But then we have another one. This is a strange one. They got this, they're showing this searchlight beam up into the sky, and it bends at a right angle as it connects with this UFO. It's bending the light, literally. Now, this kind of reminds me of some of the stuff that they've done on Skinwalker Ranch. You know, how were these things bending light? This is just amazing. It has a caption that says, "A spotlight operated by Sergeant Donald Berger captures a large circular object in the sky above Norwood near Cincinnati." This is one of the only surviving photographs of the object, which was seen 10 times between 1949 and 1950. 10 times. The photograph was taken by Sergeant Leo Davison of the Norwood Police Department, and it is in the public domain. The photograph on the right shows the same object with the spotlight appearing to bend toward it! Exclamation point. Yeah, that is weird. According to some of these newspaper articles, the local weather bureau and area radio stations and newspapers were flooded with hundreds of calls from residents that reported seeing comets and balls of fire over downtown Cincinnati. Comets and balls of fire. Wow. One eyewitness said it looked like two weather sealing balloons, but they weren't moving, adding that the wind was blowing at 25 miles per hour that evening. If they were balloons, they would have moved, the witness stated. Another witness saw two balls of fire that seemed to glow dim and then get bright again. Still, another reported a cluster of stars over Cincinnati. So it seems like we have a variety of phenomena occurring at the same time. Now, of course, even back then, they're talking about weather balloons, but the person that had enough, that they interviewed had enough common sense to say, well, the wind was blowing 25 miles an hour, so how could these things be standing still? The newspaper explained the incident away by saying that the nearby Albee Theater had also used searchlights that evening to promote a movie premiere, and that people had simply seen the carnival lights and theater lights interacting in the atmosphere. 1949, man. The media is still there to debunk, deperson, and throw dirt on people. Regardless, 2 days later, the incident at the carnival was brought to the attention of the Department of Military Science and Tactics, where it was given a closer look. That was the DMST. According to the DMST documents about the incident, available online, it says the object was reported to have remained stationary for more than 3 hours and appeared to change color in the light beam from a sort of phosphorescence appearance to a bluish color if held in the light, and when the beam was removed, the object remained visible with what has been described as a luminous appearance. Possibly because the sighting had been reported in local newspapers and thus bringing national attention, the DMST decided to send the report to Project Grudge. You know, how open-minded were those guys going to be with a name like Project Grudge? Later renamed Project Blue Book at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, where UFO sightings were officially investigated. Meanwhile, the sightings in Norwood continued. The carnival first incident occurred August 19th. Intrigued by what he had seen, Sergeant Berger, sometimes accompanied by Father Miller, began to use a searchlight to look for the object again. On September 11th, he spotted it at 15,000 feet above Norwood. However, when the spotlight focused on the object, it disappeared within a few seconds, traveling straight up. That sounds like the one that they seen over at the Chicago airport there about 15 years ago. Just hovering there, this giant craft, and then when it goes straight up. Doesn't sound like anything we have. According to his log, Sergeant Berger then spotted it at a much higher altitude. He states that several thousand people saw the object that night, and that Wright-Patterson was notified by phone as they were during their first sighting. Sergeant Berger and other witnesses, including the mayor of Norwood, saw the object again on September 17th, this time in nearby Milford from a different vantage point, and then again in Norwood on October 24th, November 19th, December 20th. However, the oddest incident occurred October 23rd, according to his logs. Sergeant Berger, Father Miller, a man named William Winkler, and an editor and reporter from two large newspapers used the searchlight to spot the object several times between 7:15 and 10:45 p.m. On this occasion, which was also reported to Wright-Patterson, it was documented that two distinct groups of triangular-shaped objects seemed to come out of the main disk. Each group had about five objects. They came down the beam, then turned out of the beam. The same performance was repeated about half hour later, One witness stated that the descent of the object was accompanied by a high-pitched whistle or whine. Another wondered if he was looking at an alien base or a mothership. So these things are coming down the beam of light that's being shined up on them. They're definitely interacting with these people that are shining this searchlight up in their direction. This just goes to show you somehow they're trying to communicate back and forth, I think. Sergeant Berger concluded his log that evening. The disc was still visible when I turned out the light for the night. Interestingly, two members of the Air Force along with two scientists were present at the December 20th sightings. Then 3 days later, Project Grudge quickly issued its final report on the incidents. The report comes to no conclusion about what was seen by witnesses, but seems to lean on the opinion of one of the scientists present on December 20th. The man's name is classified. Yes, we must protect the debunker. But he apparently brought a telescope to view the object. His conclusion was that what people had seen was an atmospheric phenomena involving refractions from the searchlight beam. The object, he said, was simply the beam reflecting off a high layer of thin clouds. Yeah, don't worry about the mothership. Don't worry about these triangle craft that were seen coming out of this thing, releasing, you know, smaller ships or whatever. Nope, nothing to see here. Nothing that violates the laws of physics. You're simply seeing a reflection of the clouds. I'm surprised he didn't call it out as being swamp gas. After being filed, the Air Force has never mentioned this incident again or provided a conclusive explanation. In fact, the report is one of few and possibly only investigative reports that has ever been declassified from Project Grudge. Now, I'm not sure what this article is written. I know that in 2015, there was a bunch of stuff released, but still, I think they've got all kinds of stuff locked up. I think we can be sure of that. Many of the witnesses present at the sightings were frustrated that the Air Force had not conducted a more thorough investigation, including interviewing witnesses, which was standard procedure. Air Force had not conducted a more thorough investigation, including interviewing witnesses. Yeah, they're going to come there, they're going to tell you what it was, but they're not going to talk to anybody who actually saw it. They also wanted the Air Force to account for the fact that Sergeant Berger, with collaborating weather reports, often viewed the objects under completely clear conditions, meaning no clouds could reflect the light. So the government came in with the help of their debunker, who didn't even have enough courage to show his own name, lied about what people saw, claimed that it was nothing more than a light refraction, tried to produce this parallel narrative, this false narrative, and the people in town were having none of it. But they just simply ignored the people in town. For his part, Sergeant Berger used the searchlight to spot the object on three more occasions, once on January 11, 1950, and on the evenings of March 9th and March 10th. During these sightings, he was in the presence of police officers, fellow reservists, and members of the public. At the March 9th sighting, Sergeant Berger reported that two small objects came out of the disc, and it looked as if the disc was pushed out of the beam. In about 10 minutes, the disc moved back into the beam. Wright-Patterson was notified, but nothing official was done. So for whatever reason, it didn't want to have the light shine on it right then, maybe. William Winkler believed and wrote to the Air Force to get on the record that Project Grudge knew what the object was, but was keeping quiet because it was a top-secret military craft. There you go. So you have this good soul. They see it. They're like, wow, this is a crazy UFO. It must be the military. Listen. 1950. However, two people present when the Air Force officials and scientists were investigating the December 20 sightings reported hearing the men discussing the size of the object. They measured it through their telescope. Both witnesses heard the men discuss the object being 10,000 feet across. 10,000, that's almost 2 miles. For comparison, an aircraft carrier is about 1,100 feet. No technology today, let alone 75 years ago, can make an object that big fly, and especially not stationary in the atmosphere. No, it certainly cannot. It says, in 1952, Father Miller appeared on a local television show to discuss the incident. He made it known that he had 10 still frame photographs of the objects as well as a movie reel. Okay, so he took pictures of it, took a movie of it. The cameraman for all of them had been Sergeant Leo Davison of the Norwood Police Department. However, since being shown to several people at the television station that day in 1952, the film has never been seen again. Well, imagine that. People take this stuff to their standard mainstream media outlets, and what happens? It gets lost. We've heard of the same thing happening in Phoenix with the Phoenix Lights. Look, if you've got this stuff, never turn the original copies over to a news station or a newspaper. Post it online, for crying out loud. Don't give that stuff away. Somebody will just lose it, or it ends up in a deep state basement somewhere. The only photograph that remains is the one seen on the previous page, which is a photocopy of the original image contained in the Project Grudge file. Father Miller said the others were loaned out to government agencies and major news organizations for evaluation, but either never returned or were quote-unquote lost. They were just stolen, dude. Whatever hundreds of people saw in the sky above Norwood in 1949, 1950, and why the Air Force didn't take the incidents more seriously remains a mystery. I think they did take them serious. I just think that we're not in the loop. Now, this one is a 1966 Atwater. It says an 86-mile police chase involving a UFO. For anyone who has seen Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind, one of the early scenes in the movie is of several police cruisers chasing a UFO through the hilly countryside and across a state line. One of the police cruisers crashes and another comes to a screeching halt as the UFO jets into the sky at lightning speed, disappearing into the darkness. This scenario, minus the crashing of a police car, is actually based on a true story that took place in Portage County, Ohio, 1966. It involved a number of law enforcement officers from several jurisdictions either witnessing or chasing a UFO for 86 miles into Pennsylvania. Then, just like the movie, the police officers watched as the object lifted into the atmosphere and then shot into outer space. The incident is considered one of the most thoroughly documented UFO cases on record, but it also ruined one witness's life. While other police officers involved in the chase kept quiet about what they had seen, Portage County Sheriff Deputy Dale Spauer was willing to talk to the media. It was he and a second deputy named Wilbur Wolf who came upon the UFO at around 5:30 a.m. on April 17th. The two deputies had come across an abandoned vehicle and got out to investigate. When they did, they heard a humming or buzzing noise behind them and turned to see a UFO hovering just above a nearby tree line. The bright, cone-shaped light came from beneath the object, illuminating the ground. Spire would later describe the object as being 40 feet across, metallic and shaped like the head of a flashlight. It's got a picture of it here. It's pretty wild. It's almost like a saucer-shaped thing. It says, the photograph seen below is of the object. It was captured by Mantua Police Chief Gerald Bookard from about 20 miles away. That thing must have been enormous. Not knowing what to do, Spiral called into dispatch, which told him to keep an eye on the object. Just then, the object began to quickly move away. Spiral and Neff decided to give chase. At one point, the deputies were traveling at speeds of more than 100 miles an hour, trying to keep pace with the object. Somewhere near the state line, a local police officer from East Palestine, East Palestine, isn't that where they had the train derailment at? Ohio saw the object, followed by Spire and Neff chasing it. He decided to join in the action. However, a short time later, just as the sun was rising, Spire began to run out of gas, so he and Neff and the local police officer pulled into a gas station where they watched the object descend several thousand feet into the sky and then straight into outer space. That was that. Apparently, at this time, what was now Project Blue Book at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base was receiving an average of two or three UFO reports a day, possibly because the organization was overwhelmed and understaffed, or possibly for more secretive reasons no one really knows. Project Blue Book quickly determined and issued a statement that the three men had chased a satellite and then planet Venus. Case closed. No more decisions. Wow, that is so completely ridiculous. Spiro, however, stood by his story, ridiculing the fact that he could tell the difference between an object in the atmosphere and something hovering 150 feet above him and a shining light on the ground that made it appear as bright as day. Well, he had a full-blown encounter. Unfortunately, he in turn was ridiculed and hounded by his peers and the media and eventually lost his job and his wife, went broke, and ended up working at a coal mine in West Virginia. He eventually opened a bar in Cleveland, though. Wow, man, they were so hardcore depersoning people back then. You think it's bad now, it was 10 times as worse in 1966. Although now deceased, the good name of Spire has been restored as UFO investigators have been able to shed new light on what happened that evening. For starters, earlier in the evening, before the two deputies ever investigated the abandoned vehicle, someone had reported a strange light in the sky. Apparently believing it was a prank call, it was ignored. When Spall and Neff later spotted the UFO, they described it as emitting a white-blue light and said it appeared to be egg-shaped with some kind of antenna on it. Spire said the object never tried to get away from or elude the police cruisers and seemed to be going about its business. It also changed directions numerous times, something satellites and Venus don't do. Also, at several points during the chase, the object seemed to stop and wait for the officers to catch up. Before joining the police chase, the local police officer from East Palestine watched the UFO approach its jurisdiction from the west at an altitude of 800 feet with no sound. He described the object as resembling a melted ice cream cone. He, however, did not see an antenna. In Pennsylvania, the object was spotted by a stationary police officer and World War II veteran, as almost all officers involved in this case, who described it as being shaped like a half a football and traveling about 1,000 feet above the ground. At first, he thinks it's an airplane that's possibly in trouble, but later he says he has no explanation for what he saw and believes it to be a UFO. However, unlike Spire, he keeps his mouth shut. I guess he didn't want to get divorced and end up broke working in a coal mine. While the head of Project Blue Book quickly attributed the incident to satellites in Venus, a scientist who assisted in the investigation at Wright-Patterson ended up writing a letter to Spire and Neff. In it, he stated that he and others, including the later head of Project Blue Book, Dr. Alan Hynek, did not agree with their boss's assessment of the incident. They believed that what the two men had chased was a real airborne object of some kind, but could not offer an explanation for what it was. Wow. Listeners, from 1973, it says, the great UFO wave of 1973 preventing nuclear war. It was something was definitely going on in the skies above Ohio in October of 1973, but whether or not it was an alien invasion of some kind or just the U.S. Armed Forces responding to a potential nuclear threat in the Middle East is up for debate. Some believe, however, that it was both. On October 6, 1973, Egypt and Syria launched a coordinated surprise attack on Israel, starting what became known as the Yom Kippur War. At first, the situation was so dire for Israel that the country aimed two nuclear weapons at Cairo and Damascus, ready to launch them if Israel was overrun. Wow. The nukes were spotted by U.S. spy planes, SR-71 Blackbirds, in an effort to prevent a nuclear conflict. The U.S. began arming and sending supplies to Israel, Operation Nickelgrass, to help push back the enemy and prevent drastic measures. It worked. However, when Israel turned the tide of war and surrounded the Egyptian army, the General Secretary of the USSR, which had been backing the Arabs in a proxy war with the U.S., threatened to deploy Soviet troops against Israel. As a result, U.S. armed forces were placed on DEFCON 3, meaning get the missiles ready, and the world came close to annihilation. Luckily, cooler heads prevailed, and peace was made. During this tense 32-day period between October 15th and November 14th, Operation Nickelgrass saw the Air Force ship 22,325 tons of tank, artillery, ammunition, and supplies to Israel on 567 separate occasions. Since C-5 cargo airplanes were vital to this mission, one of the most important bases utilized during the operation was Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which housed a massive aircraft. In the fall of 1973, there would have been airplanes coming and going from Wright-Patterson almost nonstop, mostly for reasons that remain classified. So as the U.S. military orchestrated an extremely complex logistical mission to aid Israel as quickly as possible, utilizing tens of thousands of people and multiple bases throughout the Midwest and beyond, it is no wonder that during this period, UFO sightings skyrocketed in Ohio and across the United States. But were they all military aircraft? The National Investigation Committee on Aerial Phenomena has compiled a comprehensive list of major UFO sightings that took place in the world in 1973. Many occurred in the Midwest, especially in October. Some example sightings, it says, then listed below. Now, look, we know that these things are attracted to anytime there's a war zone. And if we're on the brink of nuclear war, then, yeah, they're going to probably be in the neighborhood. Here it says Fort Wayne, September 23rd, 24th. A woman turning into the grocery store in her car sees an object shaped like an ocean liner with a rounded back and flat bottom and top. It has five rows of throbbing yellow lights. The next night, two patrolmen at Fort Wayne see an object moving slowly across the sky. They contact the local airfield, which also reports seeing the unidentified object. Wow. And it's got just multiple reports here. We'll go through them all just for sake of time. It has it goes on and talks about the Kanye incident. I mean, I could go on for 2 or 3 hours talking about this. The last one is a Trumbull County. It says a well-documented unsolved UFO case. And we'll finish up with this because the podcast is getting quite long. But it says, featured on the History Channel in numerous UFO documentaries, the Trumbull County UFO incident in the Northeast Ohio is exceptional because it was witnessed by numerous police officers and a 911 dispatcher, all of whom were being recorded as they spoke back and forth about the strange events unfolding on the evening of December 14, 1994. It was also seen by many members of the public. Some of us actually remember this. Of course, this is at the very early stages of the internet. You didn't have, I don't think, like YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and all that. But, you know, you still, you're right before, you know, cell phones become commonplace. So people didn't have as much experience to base their sightings on, so I think these sightings are almost more reliable, the eyewitnesses, in some ways than what we have today. Around midnight, Trumbull County 911 in Warren, Ohio, began receiving calls from residents about strange, low-flying lights in the sky. The first several calls were ignored, but after they continued to come in at an alarming pace, the dispatcher sent out Liberty Township police officers to investigate. One of them was Sergeant Toby Melleroa, who ended up being the first officer on the scene after a civilian walking his dog, who had also seen the object, pointed him in the right direction. Remember, people weren't calling from their cars because cell phones were just pretty uncommon. I mean, I think you still had bag phones back then. So imagine they're calling from their house. Imagine how many people actually saw this, because if only 10% of the people that could see it called in, I mean, there just had to be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who witnessed these things. As Sergeant Melleroa moved closer to the light, speaking back and forth with the dispatcher as he did, his vehicle suddenly shut off and came to a halt, and his radio stopped working. As he attempted to restart the cruiser, he said he was engulfed by a light from above. Frightened and not sure what to do, he exited his vehicle, looked up to see what he described as a giant, circular-shaped object, and intensely bright in the center section. It made no sound at all. The object was there for about 30 seconds before moving away, at which time Sergeant Melrose's car restarted without him doing anything, and his radio began to work. He later said that he didn't feel the object was intentionally trying to shut off his vehicle, but that he had somehow come too close to it, resulting in the engine and radio malfunctions. I don't know. You know, I've had the experience of being close to one of these things. The car didn't shut off, just kept right on going. I wonder sometimes if maybe these things aren't shutting the cars off intentionally because they're somehow communicating with the observer. I just don't know. Shaken, Sergeant Melleroa decided to chase the object, as did many other police officers in the area. In total, at least 14 law enforcement officers saw the object that night, with all of them discussing it openly on their radios. Nobody's worried about being depersoning then. One of the most interesting eyewitness accounts came from a Brookfield Township police officer who climbed an abandoned radio tower to get a better view. He saw three UFOs without wings that changed color in unison. The 911 dispatcher contacted the local FAA control tower, which reported that they had nothing on their radar for 60 miles in any direction. The same went for nearby Youngstown Air Reserve Base, which confirmed they had no aircraft in the air at that time. There has never been a proper explanation for what happened that night. Interestingly, when a UFO investigator requested Freedom of Information Act documents regarding the incident, the request was denied. Wow, that is interesting. So they've got the information, okay, obviously, or they would just say, we don't have this, but they're not going to give it to you. So here you go, almost 30 years after the fact, and they can't get disclosure on a UFO sighting that happened in Ohio, a simple UFO sighting. Wow. Anyway, I thought these were just fantastic cases. Kind of a long article. I hope you enjoyed it. Until next time, this is UFO Warning. Over and out.